Do you still try to make it accessible, and how would you do that?
So I think a lot depends on the audience for the problem. I mean, sometimes you're working on a problem that is going to really be of most interest to, you know, people working in some specialized field. And then, I mean, that's your target audience, and you're really writing it for those people. And other times you're solving a problem that you hope will be more, that will have wider interest. And yeah, I think you always think about, you think about who the audience is, and then you try to make what you're doing understandable and relatable to that audience. And who that audience is, you know, can be very different from one math problem to another.
That makes a lot of sense. How or when did you know you wanted to do math?
Oh, that's a good question. Yeah, so I think I actually, as an undergraduate, so when I started as an undergrad, I wanted to do physics. And then I switched after a year to focusing on math. And I think, yeah, so the main reason is just for this is just that I think in high school in the United States, math is generally not taught very well in most schools. It's not really something we would call mathematics even, right? I mean, if you think about the highest level math class in many schools is some sort of, you know, AP calculus class, which is really a class about learning to do calculations. It's not really learning to do proofs or to think about things in rigorous ways that are intricate. And so I think until I got to be an undergraduate, I didn't really have a good sense of what university level mathematics was. So I think it wasn't until I was an undergraduate that I really thought that I wanted to focus on math.
Makes sense. How has math changed the way you think?
Oh, that's a good question. Yeah, it's hard to know, right? I mean, I'm not sure how aware we all are our own thought, the trajectories of our own thought processes. But certainly, I think, you know, one way that we hope that math changes how we think is teaching us to be careful and cautious in our reasoning, and, you know, not make sort of unsupported leaps. There's one important lesson I think that math has to offer, which is, right, so if you're a math student at CMU, I think there should be at least one point in your class when you've seen your math professor be wrong about something.
Right.
Right. And I think this is an important lesson, right? So one thing I like about math is that there's no hiding from being wrong. And a mistake is a mistake. And when something is not true, it's not true, and everybody can see it. And one thing that this should remind us of is that there is such a thing as really being wrong, and anybody can be wrong. So it suggests sort of a caution about appeals to authority, right? So just because somebody's a professor or an expert or whatever, everybody can make mistakes.
Right.
And somehow, as a student, you can see those mistakes, right? And so I think it reminds us of the power of thought, right? That you, as a thinking student, can see the professor making a mistake and can see that they made a mistake, and you can be right about that.
Right.
And somehow, so this is something that's really appealing about mathematics, is that it doesn't depend on hardly at all on appeals to the authority of the, you know, the leaders of the field, right?
Right.
That any person can who has experience can sort of work through and see whether something is actually true, whether a proof is correct, whether somebody's made a mistake. So I think that there's some value in that lesson more generally, that in particular for all of us, we should remember that being wrong is a real thing.
Right.
And sometimes it's us that are wrong. Yeah.
Some of us more often than others, but,
it's a real thing, and that, you know, just being an expert on something, doesn't mean that you can't be wrong about it. And we should always remember this about ourselves.
Right. Have you ever submitted a paper and had like a big mistake pointed out to you or anything of that kind?
Oh, yeah, that's a good question. So after submitting a paper, I'm not sure about that. But certainly, I've written things down that I thought were right, and then later, you know, realized I had some problem with.
Yeah.
So thinking of good examples right now. But definitely this is something that happens, and it happens to everybody.
Right. What are you working on now? Is there a problem that you can explain in not too long?
Okay, well, one thing I can do is I can explain sort of in more detail how this the mathematics of these gerrymandering problems works. So since I just touched on, so the basic, yeah, so there the problem was how to sample, like how to generate good random samples from some from a set of geometric partitions of a shape. For example, that might be a state, and we want to divide that state into, let's say, 10 regions, all of which have roughly equal population, all of which are connected, and maybe we have some additional constraint that the shapes have to be nice in some way, like they can't, maybe the perimeter of the shapes can't be too large or something like that. And so how can I generate a random sample from this? So the basic tool here that gets used for a lot of problems like this is called a Markov chain. And a Markov chain is basically a random walk around any space. So for example, if you're, you know, in a city with a street grid, and you do and you carry out a procedure where you, at every intersection you roll a four-sided die to decide which direction to walk in. And you keep doing this over and over again so that you're taking a random walk around the city. That random walk that you're carrying out would be a Markov chain on the locations in the city, right? So over time you would travel around the city, and if you did this for long enough, you would eventually be at an essentially random point of the city. And so the crucial property of a Markov chain, the reason why, so what the name means in mathematics, is that every step, what you decide to do next depends only on where you are and not where you right. came from, right? So for example, every time you get to an intersection, you roll a die and you can go in any direction, and it doesn't depend on sort of, you know, what you did 10 steps ago. Okay, and in any case, so a random walk like this can be done not just on a space like city streets, but on any space that you can define. And so what you can do for a problem like the districting problem is define a space which is the set of all possible partitions of the state into 10 regions of roughly equal population, which are nice in shape. So that's a huge space of possibilities, right? So to keep it from being infinite, let's imagine that the districts, so the partition classes, are built out of discrete building blocks. So maybe each one is a collection of voting precincts or something like that.
Right.
So that essentially we're partitioning a planar graph. And how do we define a random walk around this space? Well, you can imagine moving from one districting to another by making a small change to it. Like maybe I find a voting precinct on the boundary of two districts, and I change which of those two districts it belongs to. And if I do that, then I've taken one step. I move from one choice of how to partition the state to another. And if I made that choice randomly, so if I had randomly chosen which precinct to change the membership of, then I would have taken a random step in this space.
Right.
And then by making a sequence of steps like this over and over again, I'm walking through this space of possible districts of the state, just like you're walking around the city if you're rolling this die at every intersection. And also just like that, if I do this for long enough, I'll reach what's called a stationary, I'll become close to what's called a stationary distribution, where my location is random, and approximately it's random with a specific distribution that I can calculate.
Right.
And so it lets me get a handle on how to generate these random samples talking about. But there are all sorts of theoretical challenges with using Markov chains in a context like this. So, you know, one thing that I alluded to just now is that if I run this chain for long enough, for example, if I walk around the city for long enough, I'm at an essentially random location. Mm-hmm. And we know that that's true, but what we don't know in many cases is how long you have to do the walk for. So for the city, if I really have something like a square grid, on an example like this, you can prove something about what's called the mixing time, which is how long you have to run the walk before you're essentially random. But for the case of a districting problem, we don't know the mixing time rigorously. And right. So we don't know how long you have to run. We know that in principle, if I ran it for long enough, I would be in an approximately random state. But we don't actually know exactly how long that would take. And in particular, it could take exponentially long in the size of the state. And so what we do for this problem is we develop statistical techniques that allow us to make rigorous statements about whether districtings are outliers without answering this question of how long you would have to run to mix.
Yeah.
But this question of the mixing time of the chain is itself very interesting. And so this is one thing that we're thinking about now, is what we can say about generating random samples by getting at this question of how long you have to run, you know, through this distributed space randomly before you're essentially at a random place. And again, the analogy is how long do you have to walk around this city until you're at essentially a random place?
Cool. Do you ever spend any time on hard problems, like problems that haven't been solved for a long period of time?
Oh, yeah, sure. I mean, in some sense, certainly almost everything we work on is problems that haven't been solved. And yeah, sometimes it's problems that haven't been solved for a long time where you think there's a lot of interest. And yeah, I mean, it's important to bounce these problems around. Otherwise, they would never get solved.
Right.
So yeah, that's definitely something that we thought. Yeah, I mean, it's a balance, right? Sometimes you're thinking about something that, you know, just caught your interest, and sometimes you're thinking about some, you know, big old problem that you've been wanting to solve for a while.
Nice. What's your Erdős number?
Oh, good question. My Erdős number is 2, I guess. Yeah, so I have a co-author that was a co-author of Erdős.
Nice. For people who don't know, Erdős number is like your degrees of separation from Paul Erdős, who is a prolific mathematician, published like 1,700 papers or something. And if you published a paper with him, your number's 1. And if you've published a paper with someone who published a paper with him, your number's 2, so on and so forth. And that's just something mathematicians brag about.
That's right. Yeah.
Who are some of your who are some of the people you look up to in math, like an idol or a role model?
Oh, that's a good question. I don't know. So, I think, yeah, so one thing that I think is really impressive is the, you know, big historical advances that were made at a time when our understanding of math was much more in its infancy. So if you think about, the sort of the intellectual leaps that were made, for example, by the first discoverers of calculus, somehow, in some sense, what that took, it's not clear that sort of anything that we do now requires as much of an intellectual leap as what happened then, in part because mathematics itself, in some sense, didn't exist, right? We didn't really have a rigorous framework in which we, could develop mathematical theories. And so breakthroughs like that, I think are really quite, I think a lot about these historical examples of, you know, what it took for somebody to break out of, the paradigm they were in, and really get to, generate a lot of insight when there wasn't a good framework for doing that.
Right.
In some sense, now we've built up this whole intellectual system, which allows us to much more efficiently, develop insight about problems. And I think somehow, the really impressive thing is that we were kind of able to do this before we had that.
Right.
But it was much harder.
How do you foster interest in math among your students or younger mathematicians?
Question. I'm not sure I know the right answer to this. I think, what I hope that I do is project excitement about math, and that it's this interesting and fun thing that should captivate us. But I mean, maybe that's a question for you, though. But, what is exciting students today about math?
Well, I think I'm different than most people. I like to state problems. And other people have a lot of trouble with this. But, I'll see something on TV or watch a YouTube video. Or the canonical example was I was, been looking at the bathroom tiling, and I was thinking, how many ways could you tile an M by M rectangle such that rotations and reflections are the same. And so that's a story that my friends always tell about me, figuring out a problem to solve. So I just see math and everyday stuff, and I'm like, maybe this is an interesting problem. And some amount of the time it is, maybe 80% of the time it's either been solved or it's not that interesting, but some of the time it comes up with some pretty cool stuff.
Yeah, I mean, this is certainly true for research math also, that the vast majority of problems we work on, we either we don't solve, right?
Right.
Or and somehow, right, I mean, the joke is, we're failing to solve problems 100% of the time, but 100% isn't exactly right. There's a slight error. Right. 100%. And that error is where everything happens, right? Every once in a while, we succeed. Yeah.
If you can't solve something and you need someone who you think is, I won't say smarter, but like more advanced than you, is there someone specific you like to bounce ideas off of?
So I don't know if most people have a person that they take problems to when they're stuck on. But I mean, there's this thing that we talked about before. Sometimes, you know, there's, you know, some problem where you know, there's some particular subject matter that you think might be relevant.
Right.
And so then you might ask somebody in that field, right? Like, is there some standard technique for this? Is there, and so certainly people do that, but then who you're asking depends on what kind of,
right.
You know, what kind of problem you're thinking about.
Would you say your focus is like on solving problems or like building mathematical theory?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, ideally we're sometimes doing both, but I think, you know, I think for me, somehow the day-to-day fun of math comes from solving problems.
Right.
But I like to solve problems where, for me, there's some, you know, bigger story about how they fit into, you know, what we're learning about.
Right.
How things work.
Have you been a professor long enough that you've seen some of your students like come and go into the like research fields of math as a professor or similar stuff?
Yeah. I have a graduate student who's a faculty member at Auburn University. And yeah, this is the fun thing as a faculty member. You see, yeah, you have graduate students come through and then they go on and they have their own careers. Yeah. Yeah.
Are you familiar with the idea of the book by Paul Erdős?
Yes, I am.
Do you feel like you've written any proofs that would make it into the book?
Ooh, I don't know. I feel like people shouldn't put their own proofs in the book. That's for somebody else to do.
For sure. For those who are listening, the book is an idea by Paul Erdős, and it's like all the world's most beautiful proofs are in there, and mathematicians just, if they're lucky, they get a little glimpse at it and they get to write it down. And Paul Erdős would say, you don't have to believe in God, but you have to believe in the book.
Yeah, that's right. The idea is that somehow there's this collection of beautiful proofs, and we're trying to find them. It almost reminds me of you know, Michelangelo would supposedly say that he could already, you know, the statue was already in the marble, right? The
right.
Sculpture. And he was just removing the excess marble around it. It was already there. He was just revealing it. So yeah, similar sort of philosophy.
Yeah, exactly. Do you have kids?
I do, yeah.
Have you tried to teach some math to your kids, or how have you tried to inspire people with a much younger audience than your students?
Yeah, so I think for kids, I mean, there's all sorts of ways that math comes up, but I mean, one really simple way of, you know, engaging with math with kids is with, you know, various types of games, right? Like,
right.
Even tic-tac-toe, right, for young kids is very mathematical, right? It's your first experience with a case study. It's trying to understand, right, can I always beat the others in that tic-tac-toe?
Right.
And then there's all sorts of variations you can put in tic-tac-toe, right? You can try to look at 4x4 tic-tac-toe. Is that the same? What about, you know, higher dimensions, right? You can
right.
draw a few tic-tac-toe boards so that you're really playing on a cube. And yeah, I think that's a fun way of introducing other concepts, you know, introducing sort of mathematical thinking younger kids. I mean, yeah, so at some point a while ago, I taught a program for middle schoolers over the summer. And there, the topic that that I used sort of as this vehicle to explore math was cryptography. So we learned about different encryption methods, you know, matrix ciphers, and you learn modular arithmetic, and And then, you know, you learn public key cryptography, which introduces you to prime numbers and things like that. And so, yeah, that's I think a really fun way to engage with medical topics for older kids. Yeah.
Does math run in your family? Like, was your dad interested in math or anyone you looked up to?
Yeah, I think it's definitely a lot of people can say that, me included, can, you know, look in their family and see some people that had, a lot of interest in math. But I'd say there's also plenty of people that don't have that. And sort of at the top of their field and wouldn't point to any family members that, for whom math was an important part of their life. So I think both of these things are really well represented in the.
That makes sense. Yeah, so my dad and grandfather both have a math degree. And so it seems that every generation has two or maybe six people, one of them has studied, which is, I think, really bizarre.
That's unusual, especially getting that far back in time. Math degrees weren't so common, right?
Yeah, right. So we're a much less famous Bernoulli family. And the Bernoullis were this famous family of mathematicians. You've been listening to Pandemonium. The opinions expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of WICT or Carnegie Mellon University. Email comments or questions to WRCT Public Affairs, PA@WRCT.org. Thanks for listening to WRCT.
You're listening to WRCT, Pittsburgh. You are listening to WRCT Pittsburgh here. My name is Steve, your host of the Deep Blues Hour. I'll be bringing you 60 minutes of classic and traditional blues in this next hour. We're going to hear from Memphis Slim, along with his buddy Jazz Gillum, with some nice piano blues. Charlie Patton recorded 1934, some final pre-war blues from the master, who originated a lot of the Delta blues sound, Charlie Patton. Plus, we'll also hear from Snooky Pryor and his buddy Homesick James. A nice live version of Dust My Broom, a classic blues tune. It's all coming up here on this hour of the Deep Blues Hour. And to start things off, we're going to hear from Louis Jordan and his Timpani 5, recorded in 1940. There you go. Louis Jordan. This is called Lemonade on the Deep Blues Hour.
Drinks lemonade. Yes, I'm looking for a chick that only drinks lemonade. I haven't found one yet, but I've been told that a few was made. Now you know the type, and I know them too. They stand at the bar drinking 10-cent brew. You ask them what they're drinking, though you already know. They'll say whiskey every time to make you spin your dough. That's why I'm looking for a gal that only drinks lemonade. I haven't found one yet, but I've been told that a few was made. I met a gal I thought was so fine. I begged her to please, please, baby, be mine. I took her out one Thursday night. She got two shots of joy juice and was ready to fight. That's why I'm looking for a gal that only drinks lemonade. I haven't found one yet, but I've been told that a few was made. Is too powerful for a woman's frame. It'll make some simple and it makes other chicks insane. It can make a girl weighing 104 feel so powerful she'll think she could even whip Joe. This I know to be a solid fact, 'cause I fell for one a little while back. She was so sweet at the start of the night, but after two drinks, wasn't nothing right. That's why I'm looking for a chick that only drinks lemonade. I'm tired of being broke the day after I get paid.
Attic Records joins you in supporting WRCT. Attic Records, located in Millvale, is open 7 days a week, providing new and used records and CDs, from metal to reggae, hip-hop to doo-wop, and all stops in between. Family-owned and operated, Attic Records pays for quality used records and CDs with no collection too big or too small. You can visit Attic Records today in Millvale or call them at 412-821-8484. If you are interested in underwriting for WRCT, you can email pr@wrct.org for more information about promotional exchanges and other partnership opportunities.
cry. You look for the day you leave some marbles on his own. But got a little child, but she tried making her home. You know what it means to be alone. Today you love some pretty baby. Tomorrow you could be crying.
Nice music there, a live recording made by Otis Rush entitled It Takes Time. That's from a release called All Your Love, I Miss Lovin', live at the Wise Fools Pub that's up in Chicago, there from Otis Rush. Plus we heard from Willie Kent, put out through the Delmark record label. That was I Had a Dream from Willie Kent. All right, up next, another Delmark issue. This is from Byther Smith, album called Hold That Train. Came out 1981. Here he is with his version of the classic song Killin' Floor. Byther Smith here on the Deep Blues Hour.
Thank you. So, if you're outside of our coverage area, remember, you can listen to WRCT online. Live streaming available at www.wrct.org. WRCT Pittsburgh. You have no excuse not to listen.
Thank you.
music there from Sunnyland Slim, entitled Highway 61. A number of people have recorded that song or something very similar, but it's just a wonderful, wonderful, wonderful track. That's from a disc called Chicago Piano that Apollo Records put out, featuring Sunnyland Slim. Plus, we heard from Snooky Pryor and Homesick James together, recording for Big Bear Records. That was their version of Dust My Broom, live recording there from Snooky Pryor and Homesick James. All right, up recordings put on Specialty Records on a disc called A One Room Country Shack, Mercy D. Walton. This is Big Mike's Hour.
I need answers to my tax questions. Where can I find them?
Need answers? Try our interactive tax assistant on irs.gov/ITA. Simply select your tax questions, provide your information, and it gives you answers. Also, check our help and resources page and try our online tax map. 5,000 tax topics from A to Z. Plus, you can access forms, publications in a variety of formats.
As I roll in my tumble, cried the whole night long. Yes, I roll in my tumble, cried the whole night long. As I got up this morning, find my baby gone. Anybody see my baby? Tell I say hurry home. Anybody see my baby? Tell I say hurry home. Well, I since my baby been gone. Yeah. If I don't go crazy, about to lose my mind.
Look at here now, man. I done told you one time. I ain't gonna tell you no more. Leave my wife alone. I take you in. And you wore my clothes. You spent my money. You slept in my bed. And you know it ain't right. You come to me. You had no place to stay. You said, Johnny, let me stay with you. I said, yeah, man, I fixed a place for you. But I found out you're going with my wife. You know it ain't right. I'ma warn you. I'm gonna warn you right now. You don't believe in. Keep on doing the thing you do. Next time I tell you, I'm gonna use my rod. I'm gonna use my rod. Oh yeah, I'm gonna use my rod. Now man, you know you ain't doing right. You know that ain't right. You're going round, yeah. You're telling everybody you got my wife. Oh yeah, I ain't gonna tell you no more. Next time I tell you, I'm gonna use my rod. Oh yeah, oh yeah, I'm gonna use my rod. Man, you know you ain't doing right. You know you ain't. I come to you as man to man to tell you, leave my wife alone. Next time I tell you, I'm gonna use my run. I'm gonna use my run. I'm gonna use my run. I'm gonna use my run.
Oh, indeed. John Lee Hooker. Gonna use my rod. That's from a OBC classic called That's My Story from John Lee Hooker. Plus Shaky Jake from his release Good Times that came out in 1960 on Bluesville Records. That was The Worried Blues from Shaky Jake. Up next, let's hear from John Jackson. Here he is with his story about John Henry. Put out through Arhuli Records and a disc called Blues with a Message from John Jackson, John Henry, here on The Deep Blues Hour.
Thank you. that John Henry had a little wife, name was Polly Ann. Slap wrote that poor Johnny want to ride, I want to be a steel driving man. I want to be a steel driving man. The John Henry hammered on the mountain, hammered so brave and so loud. Left word, poor John Henry said, best thing you drill on down. Beat that thing you drill on down. John Henry hammered on the right, steam drill was on the left. Four left, that steam drill beat me down. Hammer my poles after you're dead. Hammer my poles after you're dead.
WRCT Pittsburgh, the last bastion of pulchritude.
I ain't gonna tell nobody that the more I've done for me. I ain't gonna tell nobody what that the more I've done for me. Run me from well dark blood, throw me from heaven just down. He run me from well dark blood, throw me from heaven just down.
What was the matter? I'm on told power and telling. I don't want you hanging around on my job no more.
Further down in country, it all won't make you cry. Further down in country, it all won't make you cry.
My God, women and children, black and freight train.
Got a little sick, Dewey,
Dixie Chevrolet car. Got a little six, do it. Little six Chevrolet car. Oh, my God, what sort of car? And it don't do nothing but follow behind Harvey Parker Flower. It may bring sorrow, Lord, it may bring tears. It may bring sorrow, Lord, and it may bring tears. Oh, Lord, oh, Lord, let me see a brand new year.
Song right there from Big Joe Williams entitled King Jesus. That's from an Arhuli disc called Shake Your Boogie featuring Big Joe Williams and his 12-string guitar. Plus we heard from Charlie Patton from 1934. That was the 34 Blues from the document collection called The Complete Recorded Works of Charlie Patton. Of course, one of the pioneers of Delta Blues back in the pre-war era when blues was growing up. All right. Up next, let's hear from Brownie McGee and Sonny Terry performing live at Sugar Hill, 1961. Here they are with Worry, Worry, Worry. Brownie McGee and Sonny Terry on the Deep Blues Hour.
Worry, worry, worry. That's all I ever do. I love you so much. Worry over you. Worry, worry, worry. Worry is a hurting thing. Worry, worry, worry. Worry is a hurting thing. I may be the winner, but I worry just the same. Woo! They tell me love and worries. Thank you.
Hey there. You're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh. 88.3 on your radio device, WRCT.org on your web device. It is 7 o'clock. That means it is time for the radio calendar. Here's some stuff going on in Pittsburgh. The Cranberry Artists Network presents their first exhibition of the season entitled A View from Above or Below, curated by Mike Panza, owner of Panza Gallery in Millvale. The works will feature the artist's unique perspective on the world when seen from unusual angles. A View from Above or Below will be shown at, well, is being shown at the Cranberry Township Municipal Center, which is at 2525 Rochester Road in Cranberry Township, until April 14th. So if you want to go see the art, you have a day, because I think they're closed by now. For more information, go to their website at cranberryartistsnetwork.com. Some more art for you to look at. The Carnegie Mellon Master of Fine Art 2022 graduates will be exhibiting their work at the Miller ICA Gallery on the CMU campus. And I say will be. They are. Marianne Hoffmeister Castro, Lena Chen, Petra Floyd, and Matthew McGaughey present their exhibit called Untitled Affairs. The MFA program at CMU's School of Art is an interdisciplinary, experimental, research-based program that challenges artists to recognize social context and civic engagement as paramount within contemporary art. Students are encouraged to employ a comparative and intersectional approach to critical and cultural theories, allowing this inquiry to inform and expand what it means to be an artist and to make art within our contemporary condition. The students' works are on display through April 17th at the Miller ICA Gallery in the Purnell Center for the Arts on the CMU campus. For more information, visit miller-ica.cmu.edu. Coming to Pittsburgh this month, it's the Oakland Pop Festival. It's happening on Saturday, April 23rd in Shenley Plaza. You can experience a full day of free live local music with 10 artists across two stages showcasing the best of Pittsburgh's music scene in the heart of Oakland. Acts include Sierra, Sellers, Water Trash, Metacara, and Melt, along with a number of others. This event will be held on Saturday, April 23rd in Shenley Plaza in Oakland. Shenley Plaza, Oakland, April 23rd. Yes. You can stop by the Pittsburgh Banjo Club's regular rehearsal every Wednesday at 8 p.m. to enjoy their wonderful music and perhaps have a beverage and a bite to eat. Founded in 1988, the Pittsburgh Banjo Club is an all-volunteer band and organization that uses banjos, trumpets, tubas, and bass to perform popular music from the 1920s and 1930s. The Banjo Club rehearses at the Allegheny Elks Lodge, number 339, which is at 400 Cedar Avenue in Pittsburgh's north side. Reservations must be made by Tuesday at 5 p.m. for each Wednesday event. You can do that by calling them at 412-321-1834. Moving on to the concert list. Tonight at Stage AE Club, Pioneer Records presents 2022 release show featuring the Kill Caesar Club, Tupelo, and Seska Violet.